Today is December 3rd, 2012. This is the fourth interview with Kenneth Shapiro. As with the other interviews, we are here in Steenbach Memorial Library. And I am Troy Reeves. I'm head of the UW-Madison Oral History Program, a part of the UW-Madison Archives. Ken, we just sort of decided we have a lot of stuff we're going to try to get through over this session and the next session. You wanted to start by giving an overview of the project you're involved in. So let's start there.
Right. So that might set a background context.
Sure.
So when I arrived, we were in the International Programs Office in the college working on an international strengthening grant from USAID and an international extension summer training program. The AID program we extended into an institutional strengthening program for UW. And then I'll just read through the programs that I was involved in getting going and overseeing as background. So starting in, and these all varied from, mostly from 5 to 10 years. So starting in 1984 with the grain marketing research program in Burkina Faso, in 1985 with the Ministry of Agriculture Research Development in the Gambia, in 1987 with the Development Research Collaboration in Tunisia, and in also in 1987 working with the government of Zambia on improving their economic planning. Starting in 1988, the Summer Institute for African Agricultural Research under Rockefeller Foundation funding. In 1981, an AID program called Environmental Policy and Training. In 1992, a major research capacity development program in Bolivia, funded by the World Bank. In the same year as 1992, the Sustainable Agriculture Collaborative Research Support Program. Starting in 1992, the Babcock Institute for International Dairy Research and Development, which is still continuing. In 1993, graduate training program with the Philippines. In 1994, under Kellogg Foundation funding, the Wisconsin Food System Partnership. In 1996, the Global Livestock Collaborative Research Support Program. And also 1995-96, starting involvement with the Asian Partnership Initiative, working in Thailand and China. In 2000, in Albania, working on watershed assessment. In 2003, a linkage with Monterey Tech at Querétaro in Mexico under AID programming. In 2004, working in Uganda under a State Department linkage grant with Makerere University. In 2006, under an NSF grant, the Integrative Graduate Education and Research Traineeship Program, working in China. In 2007, start of the Corona program with the government of India. In 2009, an AID program working in India. And during that Corona and AID India program, I was also head of the India Initiative. So this amounted to a flow of about $1 million a year over that 30-year period.
Okay. And now you have, you've been taking some notes.
I just have it now.
And I typed out.
Right, and I wanted to say about that kind of a flow of external funding, three things I think were important to getting that going. One was simply being in the game, as I would put it, that I was often in Washington, often conferring with other universities, with funding agencies, and consulting companies to get leads on new opportunities and develop new partnerships. Second is having a network of contacts, not only there outside, but also within the university, and within the university being known as an office where faculty could come if they had ideas that they wanted to float for new international activities. So that as background.
Okay.
And then I've got notes, if we get started on study abroad and the Babcock Institute and
Yeah, so let's start with your work in study abroad.
Okay. The first programs that the college engaged in were in Trinidad with the University of the West Indies. And that started in the must have been the late 1980s. And that's an example of what I was talking about, being known on campus, so that Professor Larry Mueller, came to visit me with his colleague from the University of the West Indies. We sat and chatted about how the two universities might collaborate more, and one of the things we floated was the possibility of a student exchange program. And this was a semester-long program that was proposed and actually took off and has been going ever since. So it's 15 years, at least 20 years from the late 80s. I don't know. You can do the math. For Trinidad students would come up here in the fall term, and our students go down there in the spring semester. So that started us off on study abroad programs in the college. And one reason we were eager to do that was that the Division of International Studies, which runs a lot of study abroad programs, 50 or so, didn't have very much to offer to science students. And so Cal students were hardly represented at all in study abroad. So we wanted to focus on programs that would be in places where they could get a good science education, advance towards their degree by taking science-based courses outside this university. So other semester-long or year-long programs that we started on, some successful and some not, was one in England with Newcastle-upon-Tyne, one in Zimbabwe with the University of Zimbabwe, and that was before the country went into a tailspin. It lasted only a couple of years until the country got too difficult. With Wageningen University in the Netherlands, with the university in France, whose name I forget, because we were doing all this back and forth, we were invited by the EuroLeague Life Science Schools, an organization in the European community of schools, colleges of agriculture and life science, to join in a consortium with them and about five other U.S. universities. University of Queensland in Australia, which was one of our most popular programs. University in Chile, in southern Chile, again I'm blocking on the name, where we had exchange programs. Monterey Tech at Querétaro in Mexico. University of Philippines Los Baños. Thammasat University in Thailand. So those were all semester and or year programs. And then we started a series of short-term programs. And this, again, was because a faculty member came to me with an idea for collaborating with, in this case, Uganda. James Ntambi from the biochemistry department, also his joint department in nutritional science, came to me and said that his old classmate was now the vice chancellor of Makerere University in Uganda. Vice chancellor in that system is like our chancellor here. So he said, well, what can we do? And I pulled together a meeting from across campus with people who I knew in the African scholarship community. And the first thing that we decided to go after was a short-term program that would bring our students out there during a winter break, 3 weeks, and link that up with a semester seminar beforehand. So John Ferrick took a lead role in going out and exploring. He linked up with Makerere University School of Public Health, and in particular John Kachitahi, and developed that program, which has been going on now for about 12 years. Out of that has grown a student program called the Village Health Project. Students who went for those 3 weeks, the very first students said they wanted to do something to help, and so they started raising money for systems to collect water off of rooftops, store them in big cisterns under the ground. Then they went on to helping develop and build household level water filtering boxes, if you will. And that Village Health Project continues to this day raising money for helping in Uganda. Soon after that, I applied for a grant from the State Department on nutrition curriculum development, a collaboration between us and Makerere University, and we got that grant. And that lasted for 2 years, moving faculty back and forth. then applied for an internal Baldwin, Wisconsin idea grant for nutrition training that also followed up in Uganda. So that was the start of short-term programming for study abroad. Another such program, winter program, was in Mexico. Michelle Watteau of the Dairy Science Department built on this grant that we had from the USAID for a collaboration with the Monterey Tech at Querétaro. And so he takes a group of dairy students down for short-term programming. Another short-term course was the one that we did in joint with the School of Business in China, working with John Eikensayer from the School of Business. They had a program taking students to look at business industry issues on the East Coast, and we extended that out to the western part of China through our contacts. So these were a series of short-term programs. I'm sure I'm missing some. I guess Marv Wickens takes, well, that gets into internships. I should add that, taking students for research internships. Marv Wickens is doing that in England. So Dean Aberle, at our suggestion, commissioned or sanctioned the study abroad review, which called for rapid increases in numbers, which we were able to do to get our students up to, I think we were at about 100 students a year going overseas. Dean John decided that she wanted to, in essence, cut back the whole international operation in the college as a corporate unit, if you will. And part of that was wanting to shift programs to the Division of International Studies. So she shifted the semester-long programs to the Bascom operation. And I think that that's led to a decrease in Cal students, but you have to look at the statistics. The key staff people on study abroad were Sharon Baumgartner, John Ferrick, Laura Van Toll, and just recently John got a grant from the Madison Initiative for Undergraduates to continue the work on short-term study abroad and internships.
So what sort of, so these, I guess I'll ask it this way, all these programs were managed under your office?
Right.
Okay. So what sort of day-to-day things might you or your staff be doing in regard to these study abroad programs?
So the first part was establishing relationships with the partner university and finding counterparts there with whom we could work. And then doing a fair bit of advertising, recruiting, encouragement of Cal students, because somehow when you're an LNS and students are doing language, they want to go study abroad. If doing art history, study abroad. But if someone's doing biochemistry, studying abroad is not within their initial view of what they would do. So a lot of it was working to encourage our students, and then getting students who were interested, working with them about telling them what was necessary, getting them to go through the application process, then helping to organize the logistics of their transportation, making sure that they were met at the other end and that they had good housing, and corresponding with them, especially if there are any problems, setting up a 24/7 emergency response system so that if a student had a problem at any time of the day, any day, they could, there was a number and someone was monitoring, carrying around a cell phone for that. And then the reverse, when some of those programs were exchange programs, so receiving students here, reviewing their credentials, placing them in with the appropriate advisors in the college or outside the college, and sort of being a mother hen to those students. Let me tell you one story about Sharon Baumgartner. It was part of an exchange, but it was not one of the study abroad exchanges. It was with the Gambia project. We had training as part of that project, and they were sending over young scientists in their Ministry of Agriculture research program. And Sharon went to the airport late Friday to pick up one such student who, it was winter, he came off the plane in a t-shirt and sandals, and he looked very sick. And Sharon said, should we get you to a doctor? And he said, no, let me go to my apartment. And she said, no, I think we better go. So she took him to the hospital, and they admitted him. and told her that, and him, that he was in severe kidney failure. And if he had gone to his apartment, he probably would have died over the weekend. And ultimately, he had to get a kidney transplant. And I wound up bringing the fresh blood from his sister up to England on one of my trips to be typed up at Oxford University. Because the way that the kidney at that time, they had to have within 24 hours a blood draw to be able to match. And then we brought his sister over and they did a live kidney transplant for him. So it was that kind of close care that Sharon was providing and others that I think made a big difference in those programs.
Mm. Wow, it's a great story.
Yeah.
Anything else on your mind about that study abroad?
Well, it's still an uphill push on getting Cal students to study abroad. I think John Ferrick, Sharon is now retired. John does a great job with the short-term programs that we still have in the college.
Okay, so looks like the next thing on your list is the Babcock Institute.
Yeah, so the Babcock Institute for International Dairy Research and Development. Excuse me. This started, must have been the late 80s. Leo Walsh, who was the dean, had a Monday morning meeting with all the associate deans. And at one of those meetings, Leo either verbally or actually pounded on the table and said, "What is this?" And what he was referring to was the Chronicle of Higher Education annual report of special grants, which is the pork barrel grants. Mm-hmm. And there on the page was Iowa State filling up almost an entire column with their special grants. And there was Wisconsin. I think there was one brief one in the engineering college and nothing in agriculture. So he challenged us to the associate deans to come up with something. And out of the international office, we came up with the idea of an international institute focused on dairy that would do both training and development of dairy industries in emerging economies and also link those emerging economies to the Wisconsin dairy industry. And the objective was to be able to raise the visibility of Wisconsin dairy around the world so that as these dairy industries took off and they were needing to buy animals, to buy semen, to buy equipment, and some of them to buy powdered milk, they would think first of Wisconsin. Because as we saw around the world, New Zealand, Canada, Israel, Australia were beating our pants off in those economies, emerging economies. So we worked with some of our outside supporters, especially Tom Lyon, to get the attention of our congressional delegation. And they managed to get into the budget at first the initial grant of $50,000, the next year $100,000, and that ultimately grew to about $500,000 a year from the so-called special grants that were written in by Congress and then were put under the Department of Agriculture budget year by year. And that lasted from 1992, and it's still going. But special grants have now been eliminated for the most part in Congress. So the future of the Babcock Institute is very much in question. I should say that starting out, a key person was Jane Homan at the start of the program. And over the last 15 years, I guess, Karen Nielsen has been the director. I was listed as the principal investigator because they needed a faculty member, but Karen really carried the ball. A key faculty member was Michelle Watteau in dairy science, and two dairy economists, Ed Jesse and Bill Dobson, were engaged. And the Institute engaged faculty from dairy science, animal science, ag economics, food science, agronomy, the vet school, and UW Extension. Held training programs abroad and here, seminars, publications. Hordes Dairy Publication asked, and we gave them permission to do some marketing for our publications and DVDs. there was a very close connection with the Department of Ag, Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection, as well as the Department of Commerce. There were joint programs with them to enhance artisan cheese production in the state. They worked closely with the World Dairy Expo, doing training programs in English, Chinese, and Spanish. And one of the major connections is in China, and this Karen gets big kudos for that because she speaks Chinese, starting the Sino-US Dairy Center at China Agricultural University. Dean Averly was a help with that, on making an initial visit, and that's continued. At the last trip that the Chancellor, was it Chancellor Ward, made, they were signing agreements with the Shanghai Dairy Group for a long-term relationship with the Babcock Institute. So that's the Babcock Institute.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so again, from your office, were you administering the sort of the day-to-day things that need to be done for the Institute?
Right. Okay. So we would receive the grant from the USDA, the $500,000, and that in part was paying salaries for Karen and her staff, and then a lot of it was organizing training programs. So recruiting faculty on campus who were interested in getting that experience to go to Mexico, to go to Argentina, to go to China, to go to India, to work with large-scale cooperatives or industries or government to do training on the latest developments in dairy here in this country, and then bringing people from those countries here. Sometimes there would be delegations wanting to come to buy equipment or animals, et cetera, and we would host them and arrange for making visits to local businesses and to the state agencies. Mm-hmm. So, and then there was an ongoing series of publications. Michelle Watteau produced a number of those. Bob Leaning of Ag Economics produced one. There was others, I'm not sure.
Okay.
Them all. Then there was a series of sort of quarterly updates that Ed Jesse and Bill Dobson produced that were useful for our congressional delegation, latest issues in dairy trade and policy. Mm.
So when you would get a staff person like Karen, would she be physically in your office?
Yeah, and that was a big advantage because as I was starting to get involved in China, I was able to work back and forth with Karen. You know, I wasn't working on dairy per se, but I had connections in China Agriculture University, and so we were able. And similarly, when we got involved in India, we were able to bring the Babcock Institute into the India program and build that up. So it's a lot of synergy that was going on. One part of Dean John's effort to shrink the international enterprise involved moving the Babcock Institute over to the Dairy Science Department, and that developed different synergies, but I think that Karen feels that they'd have been better off staying in the international office with John Ferrick and others, where they could see sort of on a day-to-day basis new international opportunities. Mm-hmm. In different countries.
So it got moved to Dairy Science?
Right.
Does that put it in Babcock Hall?
In, it's the Animal Science, it's Indian's Animal Science Building.
So this is part of camp,
Babcock Hall is the food science.
Right, okay, yeah. All right.
So all right. Yeah, up on the fourth floor, so Karen's got a couple of offices there.
Okay, thank you. Let you get a drink there and ask about the next thing on your list, which looks like it's the Kellogg Wisconsin Food System Partnership.
Right. So this was a deviation from my international efforts, but I think it shed some interesting light on what was happening on campus, some of the campus activities. It started out because of my international involvement. Since I had done a lot of work on Africa, Kellogg Foundation invited me out to their offices, their headquarters, for a conference they were having on African development. And then during the course of the conference, I was taken aside and informed that they were launching a major new domestic program to stimulate, enhance, strengthen partnerships between universities and the outside community. And they asked me to come back to Wisconsin and encourage my dean to apply, which I did. And as the old saying goes, when you ask for it, you get told to do it. So Dean Wise, Roger Wise, asked me to write the proposal. And so I pulled together a group of faculty from across campus. We wrote a proposal. And I suggested a colleague, Dick Barrows, to lead the project. And he declined, and Dean Wise asked me to lead it. So I wound up leading the Food System Partnership Program. And as I say, the primary objective was to link faculty and students with community groups outside the university. An example is the Troy Gardens, a major involvement that we had, as that was just trying to get started. Mm-hmm. Some of the long-term contributions, I think, of that program are the undergraduate Wisconsin Idea Scholarships, and that was a brainchild in discussions that I had with Mary Rouse. Mary had been Dean of Students, and then she moved over to head the Mortgage Center. And there was an obvious place for us to work with as we're trying to develop connections beyond the campus. So we were able to put some money from the grant. It was a grant of about $3 million, as I recall, over a 5 to 6 year period. We were able to put some money towards student scholarships. Students were asked to develop a proposal that would engage a faculty member and an outside organization, and then they would be given enough money to get the project up and running. And Bob Skloot, who at that time was an associate vice chancellor or something like that, you know, that rotating business that they have up in Bascom, Bob thought it was a very good idea. So after a few years, Bob made a permanent line item for the Wisconsin Idea Undergraduate Scholarships, and those are continuing today. They send students abroad as well as out into the local community. A second contribution was the introduction of food systems into urban planning, not just on this campus, but nationally. And that was thanks to a grant that we gave to Jerry Kaufman from the Urban and Regional Planning Program here on campus. Jerry was a renowned figure, and he said to me, you know, urban planning, we have people who specialize in housing systems, transportation systems, welfare systems, but we don't in the discipline deal with food systems. And so he took it on himself to be sort of a missionary, and in fact was able to get this to the point where now food systems are an accepted part of the curriculum in urban planning across the country. And we've got a faculty member here, I can't remember his name, it's a Spanish name, who's focused just on food systems. Another lasting contribution is the Baldwin-Riley Wisconsin Idea Grants. And this was an interesting history. This is the big $20 million endowment from Ira Baldwin and his wife, Ms. Riley. And it's an annual competition that awards about $100,000 to each grant, and they give 3 to 5 grants a year. And it started when I was in conversation with Peg Geisler, with whom I worked closely. She was in Bascom working on outreach programs. And we talked about trying to raise funds for such a big program that would have an annual competition for faculty. And we convinced the Kellogg Foundation to allow us to use $250,000 from our grant to kickstart that fundraising project. And then I went to meet with Sandy Wilcox, who was then head of the UW Foundation. And I laid out for Sandy a lot of material that we had gathered about Wisconsin Idea and outreach, told him that Kellogg was ready for us to kickstart, and would he take this on or allow the foundation to take on a fundraising program. And he said, keep your money. You've given me a good idea. We've got a large grant from Ira Baldwin, over $20 million. And I'm not sure he said it explicitly, but maybe reading between the lines was the fact that different factions on campus were vying for that grant to come all to Cal's, because Baldwin was a faculty member here, or come all to wherever. And Sandy said that he would take the idea of a campus-wide Wisconsin Idea program to John Wiley, who was chancellor, and he did, and John agreed with that as being a good use for the money. So although it was not Kellogg money, nor any money that I raised, I think that we were instrumental in getting that big endowment focused on the Wisconsin idea. There's an organization now on campus called REAP that focuses on local food systems. Jack Kloppenberg and Jerry Campbell were instrumental in that. We gave them startup money. So that's the kind of thing that we did under the Kellogg grant. We also did a quarterly publication called Updating the Wisconsin Idea, which was sort of like a newspaper that was sent around. And that was gathered up after 5 years into a book called Updating the Wisconsin Idea, giving several pages to various faculty and student activities outside the campus. We did a survey of faculty attitudes towards service and found that faculty wanted to do more, but felt that they were not rewarded for doing more. That's a short summary of the outcome, and we presented that to the chancellor and provost and deans, but I don't think things have changed because of that.
Ken, can I ask you a question here?
Yeah.
I'm always interested when you hear the word Wisconsin idea, and you used it a couple of different times in this section. What is your, how do you define the Wisconsin idea?
Using the talents, expertise of the university in cooperation with outside audiences. I know it's meant to be a two-way street, and it often is a two-way street when we go out to work with the community. We often learn as much as we bring. And so that's in a simple way when I look at it. And it's a responsibility that the university has. And I see that strongly internationally. This university has benefited so much from federal funding, and the federal government sees international development as part of its mandate. And I think by association, we have similar responsibility since we've got so much knowledge about agricultural development here.
You talk about, you see the importance of internationally. I think the next thing on your list is the Asian Partner Initiative.
Asian Partnership, yeah. Let me just finish off on,
sure.
on Kellogg.
Sure.
An interesting sidebar. The foundation gave us the money up front. Typically, when you get a grant from the federal government, it's cost reimbursement. You incur the cost, the university floats the cost, and then submits invoices, essentially. Kellogg gave us the money up front, and one of my staff, Loretta Erdahl, was wise enough to put it into an account that bore interest. And that interest was then put into another interest-bearing account, and it built up something like $200,000 to $300,000. And that provided essentially venture capital for international programming and CALS. I think the last bit of it has finally been used up this past year. And that was an important side benefit. And Kellogg Foundation was very happy for us to use the money like that,
mm-hmm.
and as was the university.
So what was the time? What was the time period on the initial?
So the Kellogg Foundation grant started in 1994. And ran, I think, 7 or 8 years.
Okay, so then that money's been used basically for the next decade.
Right.
Okay.
Right. So that came.
So anything else you want to say about Kellogg or Wisconsin Idea before we? Not that you're, you've been talking about, and we'll continue to talk about Wisconsin Idea.
It's a good relationship. Kellogg Foundation at that time, personnel change all the time, but it was a collegial relationship. When we had new ideas or changes we wanted to make, it was easy to do as compared to working, say, with USAID or the World Bank, where you've got, in essence, a contract, although it's called a grant. You've got deliverables, and you've got to stick with it.
Mm-hmm.
With the foundation, it's easier to work with them.
Okay.
So, then the Asian Partnership Initiative. This started with a trip that David Ward made in 1995 to Thailand and Taiwan. And I think that he was accompanied by Dean Wise from CALS and Dean Policano from the business school. And he came back from that trip. In part, he was meeting with our alumni. In part, he met with prime ministers and university presidents. He came back eager to see UW expand its presence in Asia. And I was asked to take a leadership role, to take the lead in that. And I worked closely with Mike Hinden and Dave Trubeck, who were both in, Dave was the dean for international programs out of the law school he was, and Mike Hinden was his associate dean. So the three of us essentially started off the Asian Partnership Initiative. And we first did an exploratory visit. I'm not sure if Mike came on that trip, but Bob Steele, who was an associate dean in CALS, came. John Eikensayer from business came. I'm not sure who else. Maybe Bob Bickner from East Asian Languages. We went to Thailand and Taiwan, as the chancellor did. And this led to programs with Thailand. Taiwan really didn't lead to very much. And then ultimately, we developed programming in China, so that the Asian Partnership Initiative focused primarily on Thailand and on mainland China. So we started the, I guess I need to backtrack. in, I think it was 95, I was visited by one of our faculty members, Barry Bavister, actually a faculty member in the vet school. And as an example of what I was saying, that if people around the campus know that you're doing stuff, then they come. And so Barry brought to me a visiting professor named Weizhi Ji, J-I is his last name, who was from the Chinese Academy of Sciences, an institute called the Kunming Institute in Institute of Zoology in Yunnan Province. Anyway, so Ji came and talked about the possibility of collaboration with the Chinese Academy of Sciences, and came, that sort of came under my purview because of my role in the Asian Partnership Initiative. So he arranged for a vice president from the Chinese Academy of Sciences to come here and sign an agreement with David Ward. And then we started a competition on campus with seed money from Chancellor Ward for this Asian Partnership Initiative for faculty who wanted to start linkages with research institutes in China. So the way China's research establishment is organized, there's some universities that are quite good, Peking University, Tsinghua University, others. But most of the research is done in the Chinese Academy of Sciences research institutes, of which there are about 100 across the country. And so what we did was put out a call, cross-campus call for a competition for faculty who wanted to link up with colleagues in the Chinese Academy of Sciences institutes. We funded, we had about $120,000. We funded 12 projects, and you know, some of those that are still continuing and are doing good work. Jiming Jiang in horticulture working on the rice genome. Professor Liu in atmospheric and oceanographic sciences looking at climate change with an institute in China. Leoan Shu in industrial engineering. Jack Rutledge in animal science. John Markley in biochemistry, et cetera. So to give you a feel of how it was across campus that these grants were set up. And then in 1998, when John Wiley was provost, I approached him about traveling to China. So John and I and Kate Khalil, who was an associate vice provost at the time, and Fun Sun Chu, Chinese origin in the Food Research Institute, went to China in October of 1998. And that led to a whole series of programs in China. I'll be disjointed and say, let me talk first about Thailand, okay? Because sure. The China discussion will go on much longer.
Okay.
So in Thailand, I can't remember the chronology of travels to China, to Thailand, but we were lucky to have very well-placed alumni, both in industry as well as in government and in university. So the university that we linked up most closely with was Mahidol University, which is spelled Mahidol. And there, one of our alums was a department chair who soon became president of Mahidol University. He goes by the name of Pornchai. The last names of the Thais are too long for me to remember or to be able to reproduce. Another important alum was Vichai. His last name is Easy Vichai Rutrakul. And then outside the university, an alum name is Pong Sak, who was the head of a major publishing empire. Another alum, Piabut. I don't know, Piabut might not have been an alum, but he was high up in the banking business. So we traveled to Thailand a number of times. Kim Santiago, who was the international coordinator for the Alumni Association, went with me a number of times. So we developed relationships with Mahidol University and with the Ministry of Education and the Ministry of Higher Education, and with Thammasat University. So Mahidol and Thammasat, there are three leading universities in Thailand. Chulalongkorn is perhaps considered the Harvard. And then after that is Mahidol and Thammasat. Mahidol is clearly the leading bioscience university in Thailand, and Thammasat the leading social science university. So we developed relationships with those two universities, as well as with the ministries. For example, they had instituted something called the Royal Golden Jubilee Scholars, commemorating the 50th anniversary of the king, and they directed some of those scholars to Wisconsin, and there's a continuing flow of those people coming here. And with the money from the Asian Partnership Initiative and with money from Thailand, we were able to send our faculty back to Thailand. So a scholar would come here working on their dissertation, and then they would link up with the faculty member here, and then that faculty member would go back to Thailand for the dissertation defense and to explore collaborations. There was a program to send postdoctoral scholars here. There was a study abroad program, semester study abroad program, started at Thammasat University, which was transferred up to Bascom. Then at some point, timing I can't recall, when John Wiley was chancellor, we organized a trip for him to Thailand. By we, I say it's mostly Kim Santiago and I, and then he also went on to, we went with him to Singapore, and I think he also went to Taiwan on that trip. I didn't go to Taiwan. And I took along a number of faculty to explore possibilities. So John Roll from microbiology, Cindy Hack from School of Medicine and the Center for Global Health, Walt Stevenson from Plant Pathology, Kevin Nimi from the Center for Biology Education, Dave Nelson from Biochemistry. And we set up meetings for each of them with appropriate counterparts, and of course met with Wiley and met with leaders of the universities and the government. And then when we came back, Wiley invited us all over to the chancellor's house, and I'm not sure if we had dinner or just dessert, and sat around talking about possible future collaborations. And he was quite clear that if there was additional money needed, he would be glad to provide it. It turns out there wasn't much additional needed. So out of that came an NSF program that continues today. So John Roll put together a proposal to the National Science Foundation for their program called the International Research Experience for Students that sends 5 to 7 UW students to Mahidol for a summer of research funded by the NSF. Cindy Hack put together the study abroad program for the Center for Global Health. They have a certificate that they award that requires an international experience, so their Thai experience grew out of that. Walt Stevenson got linked up with Kasetsart University, the major ag university in the country, and a colleague there, and a linkage to one of the King's projects looking at environmentally friendly potato production. The King had encouraged potatoes to replace poppies, and the problem with potatoes is they get a lot of pests, and so these are ways to cut down use of pesticides. Kevin Niemi, who was also on that trip, I did mention, he got engaged with the Ministry of Education for long-term training programs and the revision of the curriculum, the high school curriculum in biology. So a number of programs, most still ongoing in Thailand. Okay.
All right, so as you're getting a drink here, and now you, I assume, want to shift from Thailand to China.
So I think, as I mentioned, we went with John Wiley when he was provost in 1998 to China. And at that time, the main focus was on the Chinese Academy of Sciences, and that was because of this meetings I had had with Dr. Ji from the Kunming Institute of Zoology, and Ji had good connections in headquarters. So we, this was, I think, the first official administrative visit to China from UW since Irv Shane went long, long ago. And we were greeted by various high dignities in the Academy of Sciences, sat down to very formal meetings, and we thought that this was really going to be a protocol visit. Then there was a break, and the leaders of the Academy of Sciences came back with a to-do list. They had very specific things that they wanted to get started with us, and one of them, they fastened upon the success of WARF and wanted help in converting their research to usable product. So we put together a technology transfer course for the Chinese Academy of Sciences. And what they did was they recruited from across their 100 or so institutes. They had a competition and recruited it was typically not the institute director, but the number two person to come here for, I think it was 3 weeks, for a tech transfer course. And we did that for 2 or 3 years until, I guess we started in 2000, did it 2011, and then came 9/11. So this was done in the summer. And so the third year, it was very difficult to get anyone through with a visa. So we stopped doing it with them, but actually continued with some folks from Thailand and Korea. And now this tech transfer course, the model is being used for India. So that was one outcome. Another, which surprised us, was a request for collaboration on an executive MBA program. So we came back and got the School of Business engaged with the Chinese Academy of Sciences to do a collaborative executive MBA program where our faculty went over there and did some teaching. And then the biggest thing was the Yunnan, Southwest China exploration of biodiversity programs. And so John and Georgia Wiley and Kate Khalil just went to Beijing, and I and Fun Sun Chu and his wife went out to Yunnan to do some initial exploration of that that opportunity. So some examples of work that was stimulated by the Asian Partnership Initiative, and some of which is still ongoing. I mentioned the tech transfer course and the executive MBA. The executive MBA was for about a 5-year period. Reproductive biology work on mammals in Kunming, ecology training, mapping the rice genome, atmospheric and oceanographic science, using GIS for land use planning, chemical archaeology, agricultural pollution management in the Beijing area, and then a big program on biodiversity conservation and sustainable development that I'll talk about later. There were collaborations with Tsinghua University. So Tsinghua University and Peking University are considered the top two universities in the country. So Tsinghua collaboration in physics, and the study, there was a study abroad program that we started. I had been invited to Tsinghua and met with people to talk about collaboration on the environment. Then I was taken to a separate dinner with my counterpart, who said he wanted to start a study abroad program. So we invited him back to campus here and handed that off to the folks in Bascom, since Dean John did not want that in the college. Then in Peking University, we collaborate with the China Center for Economic Research. Then this China Agriculture University that has the Sino-US Dairy Center, Nanjing Agriculture University and Yangzhou University hosted students on short-term training programs. There's work with the Forestry University in Southwest China, et cetera. Then the largest program is the that grew out of this was the National Science Foundation Integrative Education and Research Traineeship Project. And let me finish it with that then.
Okay.
This is a direct outgrowth of Dr. G. Part of our initial conversations were about the problems of preserving biodiversity in Southwest China. This is where the Himalaya Mountains sort of turn south. They go across Tibet and then they turn south and then they dip down. And coming through this area are the Yangtze River, the Mekong River, the Salween River, there's one other. And they cut deep canyons. So you've got sharp changes in elevation, which leads to rich biodiversity because you've got such different ecosystems in close proximity. Plus, you've got sort of the responsibility for the headwaters of these rivers that are the lifeblood for millions and millions, if not billions, of people downstream in China, in Southeast Asia, and in India. At the same time, you've got very poor people living in this area, and they're trying to make a living on the same land that's supporting the plants and the animals. And these conflicts were troublesome, and there was problems of, you know, can you preserve that biodiversity? Can you preserve the health of the headwaters of these rivers? And G was smart enough to know that this was not an issue for just a single discipline. And the Chinese Academy of Sciences is organized on single discipline. He was the head of the Kunming Institute of Zoology, and there was a Kunming Institute of Botany. There was a whole separate Academy of Social Sciences. And what G talked to me about was bringing the UW's skill at multidisciplinary work to bear, and that he would pull together the relevant parties in China. And so in 2000, he brought to campus 8 scientists from 4 different institutes, and I pulled together about 40 faculty members. We had about 3 or 4 days of meetings to see where there might be some collaborations. In 2002, the Chinese Academy of Sciences headquarters agreed to provide $1 million to the 4 institutes that were key to this effort to start on some of this work. And part of that was to be to invite our faculty out there for consultation. We sent faculty out in 2002 and 2004 to tour the research sites. They started sending their graduate students to our labs in 2004 and 5. And then we started to put together a proposal to the NSF. So as I was working with G and making these visits, we were seeking some way to get some significant funding. So I went down to the National Science Foundation, visiting with an old colleague from Michigan days who had moved from Michigan to NSF, kind of Bill Chan. And Bill said that we should look at the NSF IGRT, Integrative Graduate Education and Research Traineeships. So we did, and I was able to get a colleague, Josh Posner, to take a major leadership program and ultimately to become the PI for this project. He was an agronomy. Josh died a year ago, but he led the project until his death, essentially. We put together a proposal and were very highly graded, and they funded the top 15, and we were down around 17, and we didn't get that. We were encouraged to submit again, and we were told that the reason that we were not as graded as high was because the folks in the NSF were afraid about sending graduate students to do work in this exotic, hard to connect with area of China. And so our second proposal tried to allay their fears. Our second proposal was rated very poorly. We were still encouraged to apply again. And this is insights into the NSF. Each time you get a different review panel, they bring in external experts. And at that point, I said, forget it. But Josh said, no, let's put another proposal in. And that proposal was rated at the top, and we were funded for somewhere over $3 million. And that produced, I think it was 19 PhD scholars. So provided funding for their studies here, for them to spend a year in China doing their research, and then coming back here, patching together some additional funding. But it was essentially wound up about 3 years of funding for PhD students. They came, bright students. Some of them had to learn Chinese from scratch, which they did. Spent a year doing field work. The program, as I say, there were 19 PhD students engaged, 12 different departments across campus, equally split between LNS and CALS. I think there was even one out of the School of Public Health. In those days, the graduate school was able to help supplement funding because NSF only provides $10,000 towards tuition. And if you have out-of-state students, you need more. So the graduate school was able to provide $400,000. And that is, I don't think, something that they're able to do now, unfortunately. Interestingly, we needed more. The NSF came back to us after everything was set, and that led to us needing to get an extra $300,000 from internal sources. The graduate school said, sorry, we're tapped out. Why don't you go talk to Darryl Bazell? So right after that meeting, I walked downstairs to Darryl's office and told him the situation. And on the spot, he agreed to provide that additional funding. So I guess part of the moral of the story is that it takes money to get money. And in those days, this was mid-2000s, the university was able to provide essentially a $700,000 supplement to about $3.5 million for training PhD students and for our faculty to go back and forth and do collaborative research. Those students, the last of those students is just finishing up now. So.
All right, so that might be
I just want to mention Ed Friedman, who is now retired but was the senior China expert on campus, was a key to the exploratory visits as well as to both exploratory with the Academy of Sciences as well as upcountry and village interviews. We would have interviews and there'd be translations from Tibetan to Chinese to English. And then we would go back to our little rest house or inn, and Ed would say, now let me tell you what was really going on, based on the history he knew of the area and the politics that were very politely being discussed, but not as explicitly as they might be. And let me just to comment on, so you're interested in chancellors. David Ward and John Wiley were really quite supportive of these international activities.
Okay.
Both verbally as well as with seed money.
So Ken, is there anything else you want to say about, we covered a Covered a few things there. As I said, we have at least one more session, so if there's something on your mind you want to...
Yeah, just the last bit about about China. So the I think this was by the time I was over heading up Ag Economics and not in international CALS. The campus started the China Initiative, and Biddy Martin, as chancellor, made a couple of trips. And because of my history, Bousquet, who was the dean of international programs, asked me for input. So I gave them sort of the history. My last trip to China was 2009, meeting with the headquarters of the Academy of Sciences and laying out some possibilities for new programming. And I was disappointed that Chancellor Martin chose not to visit the Chinese Academy of Sciences. And so far as I know, also did not visit Peking University nor Tsinghua University or China Ag University, the three major universities we had linkages with. And I understand that when John Wiley went out on his trip just recently, he did visit the Academy of Sciences. And according to Laurie Dennis, who works on the China Initiative, there may be some renaissance of those programs. But they were a good partner, and they have top-notch scientists. It would be a shame to let that just wither away.
All right. So Ken, I want to thank you for your time today, and we'll off the record or off the recording here, we'll talk about setting up the next session and what we'll talk about then. So thank you very much.